Imagine for a second that you were looking at a map of this vast, just incredibly beautiful public desert landscape.
Right, the kind of place you'd want to spend weeks exploring.
Exactly. And, you know, because you're a taxpayer, you technically own this land. You hold a stake in it.
Yeah, it belongs to the public.
But then you learn that you're legally banned from exploring huge, sweeping swaths of it. And not because of like a natural disaster or because it was sold to a private developer, but because of a single, highly debated line of federal regulatory code.
It's a profoundly frustrating scenario, you know, for anyone who views public land as a shared inheritance. And, well, it's the exact reality currently playing out across the American West as we record this right now in April 2026.
Which is the entire focus of our deep dive today. We are unpacking this really comprehensive memo authored by Mike Isaacs. He's the founder of Timber Outdoor, and the memo is titled "The Regulation is the Trap."
It's quite a title.
Yeah, and it really is a fascinating, complex look into like the invisible regulatory machinery, the ongoing legal battles, and really the deep philosophical divides that are dictating who actually gets to access American public lands.
Before we really get into the weeds of Isaac's arguments, though, we need to lay down a quick ground rule for the listener.
Always important with this kind of stuff.
Right, because this memo, it pulls absolutely no punches when it comes to the politically charged actions of both the Biden and Trump administrations. So, to be completely clear to you listening, we do not have a dog in this political fight.
We really don't.
We are not endorsing any of the viewpoints, the policies, or political figures mentioned today. We are taking absolutely no sides here. Our goal is strictly to impartially report on the content provided in the source material and convey the original author's arguments.
Yeah, we were just the guides to the text. And the immediate stakes here in the text are massive. We're looking at the closure of 2,200 miles of off-highway vehicle or OHV trails.
And that's in the Western Mojave, right? The
Yeah,
area known as WEMO.
exactly. WEMO. And I mean, 2,200 miles is not, you know, a localized trail maintenance issue. That is a landscape-level shutdown of public
It is
access.
huge.
Right. But the memo argues that to understand how a closure of that magnitude even happens, you can't start by looking at the legal code. You actually have to start with the underlying philosophy of the agencies themselves.
Yeah, and the author builds this entire argument on a clash of two opposing ideologies. It's really about humanity's core relationship with nature. So the dominant philosophy currently driving federal policy is what the memo calls the low view of man.
The low view of man.
Right. This framework operates on the baseline assumption that human presence is inherently a toxin to the natural world. Success in conservation, under this view, is measured exclusively by exclusion.
So just keeping people out.
Exactly. Isaacs points to the language of the Wilderness Act itself, which literally, legally defines a human being as a visitor who does not remain.
Wow, a visitor who does not remain.
Yeah. If you accept the premise that human presence equals habitat degradation, well, then the only logical policy solution is to systematically minimize human presence.
Okay, let's unpack this for a second because I struggle to completely reject that premise right out of the gate, to be honest.
Sure, it makes a certain kind of sense.
Right, like if you want to keep a museum pristine, you don't invite people to track mud across the floors. You restrict access to the art. Doesn't it just make intuitive ecological sense that fewer humans wandering through the desert equals a healthier habitat for the wildlife living there? Why is the author arguing that the muddy boots are actually beneficial?
Because Timber Outdoor is advocating for the inverse philosophy. They call it the high view of man, or habitat and terrain unification.
Habitat and terrain unification.
Right. This view treats educated, invested outdoor users not as a degrading variable, but as the ultimate stewardship
Very
infrastructure.
interesting.
The memo posits that dispersed recreationists, so the overlanders, the campers, the off-road riders, they actually act as a perpetually present unpaid monitoring network.
Because they're actually out there.
Exactly. They cover spatial extents and time periods that no federal agency could ever hope to replicate. They are the ones noticing when, say, an invasive weed chokes a wash, or when a spring dries up years before an underfunded BLM botanist might survey that specific acre.
But, you know, that stewardship model really only works if the low view of man is fundamentally wrong about human presence destroying the ecosystem.
And this is where the memo gets incredibly pointed about the WeMo data.
Right, because Isaacs notes that the primary justification for shutting down those 2,200 miles of trails was to protect the desert tortoise.
Yeah, the desert tortoise is the anchor for a lot of this.
Yet he claims there's a glaring lack of peer-reviewed data in the actual WeMo record, proving that the trail closures helped the tortoise population recover at all.
And that data gap is the absolute crux of the author's argument. There is no before and after demographic measurement proving the tortoises are thriving purely because the OHV trails are closed.
So they're just guessing.
Well, the agency is relying on the assumption of benefit rather than empirical proof. And that assumption, it fractures completely when you look at how the government treats other interests on the exact same Mojave landscape. The memo introduces this stark contrast through the massive utility-scale solar farms currently operating in tortoise habitat.
Okay, this is the part that I find so difficult to square. Like, the memo lists these massive developments. The Ivanpah Solar Energy Generating System, the Aretina Solar Center, the Rough Hat Clark County Project.
And these are not small footprints?
No. Aretina is 2,300 acres. Rough Hat is 2,400 acres. And the government approved these developments knowing full well they would decimate the local tortoise populations.
No, absolutely.
The memo even notes that Ivanpah alone caused the VLM to revise its estimates to as many as 140 adult tortoises displaced or killed, along with hundreds of juveniles. So how is the government legally justifying shutting out a family on a dirt bike to save a tortoise while simultaneously authorizing a bulldozer to blade thousands of acres of that exact same tortoise's habitat? I mean, is it just a matter of corporate lobbying budgets?
Well, the mechanism of that discrepancy is rooted in how the government views mitigation.
Mitigation, okay.
Yeah. When a solar conglomerate wants to blade 2,400 acres, they bring millions of dollars in mitigation funding to the table. They buy offsetting land or they fund biological opinions.
Right, they can pay to play.
Exactly. The regulatory apparatus knows how to process and approve that kind of transactional environmental impact. But a family camping or riding trails, they don't write a $1 million mitigation check.
No, they just buy a park pass.
Right. So the agency views dispersed public recreation as an unmitigable zero-sum impact. So the solar farm gets a permit and the trail gets closed.
Okay, but if the scientific justification for trail closures collapses under the weight of those solar farms, what legal mechanism is the BLM actually using to enforce a 2,200-mile shutdown? The agency must be relying on some kind of regulatory technicality if the ecological math doesn't add up.
They are. They're relying on a very specific line of the Code of Federal Regulations. It's 43 CFR section 8342.1.
Catchy name.
Very. It's widely known as the minimization criteria. This is the internal regulation that dictates how the BLM evaluates travel management plans. The rule requires that trails be located to, quote, minimize damage to soil, watershed, vegetation, air, wildlife, and other resources.
All at once.
Yes. The agency must minimize impacts to all of those categories simultaneously.
Minimize. That is the trap Isaacs is talking about in the memo's title.
That's the one.
Because it doesn't say reduce impacts by 20% or mitigate down to a historic baseline. It simply says minimize.
And legally, that is a mathematically impossible standard to finalize. Well, how do you definitively prove in federal court that an impact has been minimized when the regulation provides no numeric target and no defined endpoint?
You can't.
Exactly. You cannot. The memo argues that this ambiguity isn't a careless mistake. It is the central feature of the regulation. Because the standard demands an endpoint and never defines, the agency can never prove it did enough to satisfy its own rule.
Which leaves every single trail permanently vulnerable to litigation.
Precisely.
It's like a boss telling you to minimize mistakes on your weekly reports, but flat out refusing to show you what a flawless report actually looks like.
That's a great way to put it.
You're just perpetually in trouble.
Yeah.
And anyone in the office who wants to get you fired can just pull your report and say, well, you didn't minimize enough.
Yep.
And the real irony, Isaacs points out, is that Congress actually did provide a workable standard decades ago, didn't they?
They did. In the Federal Land Policy and Management Act of 1976, or FLPMA as it's known.
FLPMA, yeah.
Congress explicitly instructed the BLM to, quote, prevent unnecessary and undue degradation of the public lands.
Which makes sense.
Right, because that is a threshold standard. The agency can objectively demonstrate when they are preventing undue degradation. And courts have repeatedly agreed that the BLM was meeting that congressional standard.
But the WingO trails got closed anyway. because they tripped over the internal rule they wrote for themselves, even though they were passing the test Congress gave them.
Exactly.
Which really makes you wonder, if an agency writes an impossible rule that only serves to open them up to endless lawsuits, you have to ask, who is actually pulling the levers inside that agency? Who benefits from a mathematically impossible regulation?
Well, the memo answers that by detailing the mechanics of institutional capture, specifically through the revolving door between activist organizations and agency leadership.
Here's where it gets really interesting.
It really does. Isaacs argues that the people suing the government to restrict access and the people running the government are frequently the exact same individual.
The exact same people.
Let's look at the Biden-era example provided in the text. In 2021, Nada Wolf Culver was appointed as deputy director of the BLM. For the 16 years prior to that appointment, she was at the Wilderness Society.
Yep.
And she was heavily involved in developing the exact legal strategies used to challenge BLM travel management plans, including the original litigation over WeMo.
So she spent over a decade as a plaintiff's attorney hunting for vulnerabilities in the BLM's armor.
Right. And the irony deepens when you look at her tenure as deputy director. The successor WeMo lawsuit was filed by her former colleagues at the Center for Biological Diversity and the Sierra Club. The case was literally captioned Center for Biological Diversity v. Culver.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The activist who spent 16 years suing the BLM was now the named defendant being sued as the BLM by her own former network.
But how does that actually change the culture of the agency, though? Does she just immediately settle the lawsuits?
It's more structural than just settling a single case. On January 17, 2025, just 3 days before the presidential administration transitioned, Culver, who was then serving as acting BLM director, signed a national policy memorandum.
3 days before.
Yes. And that memo codified exactly how field offices must apply the minimization criteria across every acre of BLM land nationwide. She used her insider knowledge to cement the incredibly strict interpretation of that ambiguous, impossible standard.
Uh-oh.
And then shortly after the administration changed, she stepped down and returned to the Wilderness Society as its president. She essentially installed the very regulatory traps her organization relies on to win lawsuits, and then return to the organization poised to file those lawsuits.
That is wild.
Mm-hmm.
But Isaacs makes a point not to let the conservative side of this dynamic off the hook, right?
No, he doesn't hold back there either.
Because you might look at the Culver example and think, oh, this is purely a tactic used by environmental groups to lock up the land. But the author applies the exact same scrutiny to the extraction industry, showing how they weaponize the exact same revolving door.
Exactly. The text details the Trump-era nomination of Kathleen Sciamma to lead the BLM. Sciamma was the president of the Western Energy Alliance, which is a massive oil and natural gas lobbying group.
Okay, so same pattern.
Just like Culver, she came to her nomination with an extensive track record of filing lawsuits against the BLM. The only difference was that her lawsuits were aimed at forcing the agency to open up public land to drilling and extraction.
So she gets in, and suddenly the agency starts making decisions that heavily favor the lobbying group she just left.
The memo catalogs the fallout pretty clearly. Under that administration's policies, 13.1 million acres of federal land were open to coal leasing, the 2001 roadless rule protecting national forests was rescinded, and extraction royalty rates were rolled back to levels not seen since 1920.
Since 1920.
Yeah, resulting in billions of dollars in lost taxpayer revenue.
So this all synthesizes into what Isaacs calls the scholastic trap.
Yes, the scholastic trap.
He's arguing that the system isn't actually broken. It is working flawlessly for the concentrated interest that designed it. And whether the prevailing ideology is, you know, conservation exclusion, pushing people out, or energy extraction, tearing the land up, both extremes share that foundational low view of man.
That's exactly his point.
Neither side views the dispersed public, like the family camping or the taxpayer hiking, as having a valid seat at the table. They both just want to manage the public entirely out of the equation.
Right. The paddle simply changes hands every 4 years, but the public never actually gets a turn to serve. The regulatory traps remain in place regardless of who sits in the Oval Office.
Okay, but if this revolving door and this impossible regulatory framework have been entrenched for decades, why is Isaacs framing right now, April 2026, as the breaking point?
Good question.
The memo outlines this massive collision of events peaking right at this moment, driven by a recent Supreme Court earthquake and a sweeping global land initiative.
Yeah, to understand the legal earthquake, we really need to look at the death of Chevron deference.
Oh, Chevron deference.
Right. With the Supreme Court overturning Chevron in the 2024 Loper-Bright v. Raimondo decision, the entire landscape of administrative law fundamentally shifted.
Because, I mean, under Chevron deference, it was like letting the IRS not only audit your taxes, but also write the dictionary definition of what the word income means right in the middle of your hearing.
That's exactly what it was like.
The agencies wrote the ambiguous rules, interpreted them however they saw fit, and the courts were forced to blindly defer to them. But now that Chevron is dead, how does that actually help the off-roaders fighting the WeMo closures right now?
It gives advocates a brand new, incredibly sharp legal crowbar, and we are seeing it deployed in the live timeline, the memo outlines. On April 15, 2026, the Blue Ribbon Coalition, or BRC, officially filed to intervene in the federal lawsuit over WeMo. And on April 17th, the Department of Justice filed an appeal. The BRC isn't just fighting the BLM's interpretation of the minimization criteria anymore.
Yeah.
Because of Loper-Bright, they're asking the courts to independently evaluate whether the minimization criteria themselves exceed the authority Congress granted in the FLPMA statute.
So they aren't just playing by the agency's rules anymore.
No, they are trying to strike down the impossible standard entirely.
They are going for the throat of the regulation itself.
Exactly.
But the memo scales this fight way past the borders of the Mojave Desert, doesn't it? Isaacs connects this hyperlocal trail closure fight to the UN's Kunming-Montreal Global Biodiversity Framework.
Widely known as the 30 by 30 initiative.
Right, 30 by 30.
Yeah, the 30 by 30 framework is an international agreement adopted by 190 nations, and it aims to protect 30% of the Earth's land and water by the year 2030. The text of the framework explicitly identifies human activity, particularly motorized access, as a threat to biodiversity.
Which ties right back into that low view of man.
Perfectly. And the memo notes the political back and forth here. President Biden signed an executive order committing the U.S. to 30 by 30, while President Trump later overturned it.
But Isaac's point is that those executive orders are essentially theater, right? Because the invisible machinery of the agencies is still running the 30 by 30 playbook, regardless of who is president.
Precisely. The WeMo closure is the perfect example of this. The memo argues that 30 by 30 is being enforced domestically through the back door. You don't need the U.S. Senate to ratify a controversial U.N. treaty if you already have a domestic regulation like the minimization criteria that can be weaponized in court to shut down 2,200 miles of trails in a single ruling.
Because the result is the same.
Exactly. By weaponizing a standard travel management plan, the agency creates a de facto landscape-level wilderness designation. Every closed trail serves the 30 by 30 goal of excluding humans, bypassing the congressional voting process entirely.
Which brings us to the ultimate question Timber Outdoor is trying to answer.
How do you fight back?
Right. So what does this all mean for you? If Mike Isaac sees this massive entrenched system, the impossible regulations, the insider capture, the backdoor international frameworks, how do you actually beat it? He insists that just funding the Blue Ribbon Coalition to fight in court isn't enough to defeat a prevailing worldview.
No, he says you have to physically build a new model that makes the old one obsolete.
Build a new model. And that alternative model is the physical manifestation of habitat and terrain unification.
Yes. Timber Outdoor Solution isn't just another legal brief. It's putting families physically on the land to prove that human presence generates a net positive ecological outcome.
How are they doing that?
The memo details the Timber U Trail Pods. These are solar-powered, off-grid base camps deployed onto public lands, which allow families to use the environment as an active classroom. They call it road school.
Road school. I love that. So instead of sitting in a traditional classroom learning about a desert ecosystem from a textbook, a family is parked on a riverbank, actually walking the landscape, identifying the flora, and interacting with the geology. But how does that counter the BLM's data narrative?
Because those road school families are actively generating better data than the agencies themselves. Isaacs grounds this claim in cited scientific research, pointing to studies published in Landscape Ecology and PMC.
Okay, so there's science backing this up.
Real science. These studies demonstrate that recreational trail users systematically contribute vastly superior species detection data and invasive plant tracking compared to underfunded government agencies.
Mm-hmm.
A botanist might survey a specific quadrant of the Mojave once a decade.
If they even have the budget for that.
Right, but an overlander or an off-road rider, they traverse miles of transects every single weekend.
Yeah.
They notice when the ecosystem shifts.
Because the frequency of their presence is what makes them so valuable. When the BLM closes a travel management plan and evicts the riders, the land doesn't magically become more protected. It simply becomes unmonitored.
It feels dark.
Yeah. The government is forcefully evicting the most invested, comprehensive stewardship infrastructure it has, an infrastructure it never even had to put on the payroll.
That's Isaacs's core argument. He says that conservation frameworks that mandate the exclusion of human beings aren't actually practicing conservation. They are executing dispossession dressed up in scientific language.
Dispossession, that's a strong word.
It is. Timber Outdoors' belief is that to ultimately win this generational argument, you have to outscience the agencies. You have to document the habitat, count the species, publish the spatial data, and build a demographic of users who defend the land with empirical evidence rather than relying solely on reactionary litigation.
The psychological aspect of that is what really resonates with me. The core message here is you protect what you know, and you only know what you have access to.
Absolutely.
The child who learns about erosion by physically climbing over rocks or, you know, learns about drought by seeing a dry spring bed while camping, they grow up to be the ultimate fiercest steward of that landscape.
They have a personal stake in it.
Right. If you lock that child behind a gate in the name of preservation, you aren't just losing a weekend recreation spot. You are actively severing the connection that creates the next generation of conservationists.
We really have covered a massive scope of material today. We started with the philosophical debate over whether humanity is a toxin or a steward. We dug into the mathematical impossibility of the minimization criteria under 43 CFR, section 8342.1.
The trap itself.
Yes. We examined the revolving doors of Washington, where plaintiffs become agency directors. We looked at how the fall of Chevron deference is giving advocates a new weapon against backdoor 30 by 30 enforcement. And finally, we looked at a family parked out on a desert riverbank, actively choosing to learn the landscape by being immersed in it.
It really is a phenomenal blueprint for understanding the invisible forces shaping our public lands.
It is. And as we wrap up our deep dive into Isaac's memo, I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over. It builds directly on the philosophy we've explored today.
Let's hear it.
If the law of the land strictly defines human beings as visitors who do not remain in nature, how does that legally enforced alienation fundamentally alter the psychology of an entire generation?
Wow.
If we are legally required by our own government to view ourselves as a toxic presence to the natural world, do we eventually lose the intrinsic human instinct to care for it altogether?
That is a profound question to walk away with.
Mm.
Think about that map from the beginning of our conversation, the vast, beautiful public land that you technically own. How you view your rightful place on that map changes absolutely everything. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep exploring, keep reading, and most importantly, keep asking the hard questions about the land you own.